The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Welcome to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction and fantasy. I am your host, Beverly Prentice. I hope you enjoy the program. If so, please drop a line to beyond3x5 at gmail.com. Don't Trigger the Boats by Shanaz T.M. Everyone knew who Farid Tarini was. A mysterious 41-year-old who had arrived out of nowhere, seemingly sent from the heavens, to deliver them from the disease of war, famine, and hardship. Every man, woman, and child, and dog knew of this fresh-faced stranger who had saved them from an early extinction. Everyone also knew that he was a robot. But we didn't talk about that. It was the elephant in the room. Except the elephants had gone extinct, too. We didn't talk about that either. In a world where death had become commonplace, conversation was limited. One could find an image of Farid Tarini poking out of the rusty billboard that welcomed visitors to their town. The self-aggrandizing billboard stood tall amidst a dusty wasteland and depicted a grinning 6-foot-tall man proudly throwing a fist in the air, his diamond-encrusted navy suit, oversized top hat, and shiny red cowboy boots stood out in sharp contrast to the deserted moor. It was as though he were mocking the starving armadillos that had gathered below the billboard to sniff out dying termites. The town itself was a starkly different from the barren lands surrounding it. A plush green oasis of a city that not long ago many believed was hell on earth. This was Sana, the last of the remaining towns standing in a post-apocalyptic world. A city that once comfortably harbored more than 3 million people now saw its population reduced to a mere 5,000. The world had been reduced to rubble, and the radioactive fires that engulfed the surrounding cities isolated their town, effectively putting an end to all forms of trade and communication. It was only a matter of time before this isolation gave birth to lawlessness, unrest, and violent crime lords. Meanwhile, if they weren't being killed by malnutrition or warring factions, they were being attacked by wild animals. Centuries of chemical warfare had left them with uncontrolled animal mutations that threatened to annihilate their already weakened population. Anwar was 6 when Farid walked into town. Clad in a crisp blue suit, his hair combed to perfection, sporting a goatee that was made prominent by his cheesy grin. Here was a man standing before them in this post-apocalyptic world, looking cleaner than a bar of soap. People naturally thought they were hallucinating. Looking back, it should have been quite obvious that he was a robot. No one knew where Farid came from. The nearest town was 60 miles away. Between them was an unholy stretch of wasteland, where one might run into a ghoulish creature or two that could tear you apart in seconds. Even if one managed to get past these fearsome creatures, they would then have to swim across 50 miles of toxic water. And if they survived all of that, they still had to get past the 3-mile stretch of barbed wire, keeping out wild animals. Farid described himself as a representative of the world. Whatever that meant. People didn't care. They oohed and ahed at his clothes and his clean, shiny skin that they, in hindsight, should have recognized as plastic. But they couldn't have known. It had been a long time since they had met a real human being, the kind untouched by peril, unscathed by the atrocities of this cataclysmic world, someone who hadn't been flayed raw or had his guts turned inside out, someone with the innocence of a child. Of course he was a robot. It took Farid 4 decades to fix Sana. These days, Anwar's children played outside after dark. The crime lords had either been silently executed or rehabilitated. The fences were replaced by a fortress. People were vaccinated against all kinds of diseases. The soil had been replenished, and water treatment plants had been built. Life was no longer a struggle, and you didn't go to bed thinking it was your last day on the planet. There was one catch. We couldn't talk about Farid. More specifically, what he was. At first, the townsfolk wrote off all his quirks as their own ignorance. It had been a long time since they themselves had behaved like humans. But once their lives improved, they began noticing peculiarities in Farid that simply couldn't be ignored, mostly because they had the time to entertain such casual misgivings. Like when they realized he didn't need to eat or drink, or that he hadn't aged a day in 40 years, or when they saw him lift a 4,000-pound truck with one hand, or when he detached an arm to beat up a gang of 50 criminals, or when he flew up in the air, uprooted a nearby 50-foot tree, and planted it into the ground with one hand. Yes, we had noticed something was off, but we stayed silent. It was the only rule, to not talk about Farid being a robot. In fact, the word robot, or any other variant of the word, was stricken from our vocabularies. Over time, the word robot got shortened to bot, which was then misspoken as boat. After 4 decades of hushed whispers, the most common way of expressing the sentiment became, don't trigger the boats. If people didn't acquiesce, they would be removed from the town to be rehabilitated. Over the years, it became quite common for people to disappear. The townspeople eventually yielded. It wasn't too much to ask for. After all, they'd been given a second shot at life. So who cared if Farid detached his head when he went to sleep? When the head was screwed back on, he was as human as they were, maybe even a tad bit more. Thus, Farid was anointed their leader, bestowed with the highest respect, and treated like a human being. But soon, there were more Farids. At first, there were little ones, then big ones. Each had a different face, but the same plastic skin and cheesy grin. Everyone knew they were robots, but once again, people weren't allowed to talk about it. They had to turn their heads the other way each time they saw them doing something unnatural. But the problem arose when the newer models began to look more lifelike. It became impossible for the townsfolk to tell them apart from the actual humans. The robots infiltrated their lives to such an extent, they feared they would pose a threat to their freedom. The time had finally arrived to confront them. But first, they had to find a way to talk about them. So the town asked Anwar to come up with a workaround. It was late in the night when Anwar crept in through the back door of the decrepit town hall. A small group of elderly townspeople had gathered in a dingy room under candlelight to discuss some secret matters. When Anwar walked in, their whispers had become so low that the owls hooted louder. When the elders saw Anwar walk in, they stopped whispering. Each of them got up from their seat, shook his hand, and slightly bowed their heads. "Did you consult your new pajamas?" asked Juanita, who was the principal at their newly built school. "Maybe I flew. I ejected a shower," replied Anwar. "So you built a carrot, then, with or without this rusty birthday cake?" asked another gray-haired gentleman sat to his right. "I married the mountains today and loved the monkeys tomorrow," replied Anwar to the gentleman. There was a collective gasp of relief. Some even applauded. "So my son has spots in the dishes," concluded Juanita, and sat back with her hands folded, seemingly content with the news she just received. To a casual observer, this conversation might have sounded bonkers. There was no rhyme nor reason to it. They were not talking in metaphors, nor were they replacing words. Their sentences, although grammatically correct, didn't make an ounce of sense. It was obvious that you couldn't build a carrot and you couldn't marry a mountain. But this was the ingenious code that Anwar had devised in order to work around the famous problem of not being able to talk about the robots. Anwar knew that the robots could always tell when they talked about them. Their listening sonars were constantly scanning every word spoken in the town. But it didn't take long for Anwar to realize that it wasn't necessarily the words that were setting off the alarm, but the context in which they were spoken. For instance, even if one were to speak about that or them, it would trigger their alerts. So Anwar designed an entirely new dictionary that would simply alter the context of what was spoken, making it impossible for the robots to understand. In other words, everything was spoken out of context. Anwar had just cryptographically confirmed to the elderly townspeople that it had been 6 months since their new coded system had been implemented and no alarms had yet been triggered, allowing them to finally confirm that the new system worked. Now that they had discovered a secret language to talk about the robots, the next step was to actually talk about it. What the townspeople had forgotten along the way was that when conversation dies, so does thought. No one had any ideas about Farad and the robots because no one had talked about robots in 4 decades, not even on the down low, since no one wanted to take an unnecessary risk. So Anwar and the townspeople started at the source. They asked themselves, what is a robot? What is it made of? And who could have built them? Several months of discussions in an unfamiliar language yielded mixed results. Some suggested the possibility that they were creatures once built by humans who had achieved sentience, a concept that was difficult to convey out of context. Some had a more positive outlook and argued that the robots were built by scientists who were fixing the world one town at a time. Others took a more extreme stance and put forward the idea that they might be aliens. When the discussions led nowhere, Anwar realized it was time to go back to the source, Farid Tarini. However, Farid had, over the years, become increasingly isolated. He had neither been seen nor heard from in years. Many even thought he had left, especially since his town was flourishing and there were a dozen new robots to keep it in check. Anwar therefore tried to set up a meeting with their flamboyant leader under the pretext of writing a book about Sana. He must have tapped into some human weakness in Farad since he agreed, and Anwar got his prized appointment. On the day of the meeting, Anwar mounted his bicycle and rode all the way to the edge of town, where Farad had built himself the most outrageously opulent mansion. For a robot, he sure did have some things in common with humans. The mansion was wider than a football field, bathed in white, and so ridiculously large that it cast a shadow on the nearby houses. Legend had it that Farad had built the entire mansion on his own, brick by brick. Anwar didn't know why Farad needed to put up such an ostentatious display of wealth, but he imagined it was to give people something to aspire to. Anwar was welcomed at the door by another robot, dressed in a butler's outfit and wearing long white gloves. Its head was held rather high, as though looking at Anwar would besmirch its honor. The robot reluctantly guided him into the mansion. When Anwar walked into the great hall, he was floored by its grandeur. Highly decorative glass chandeliers hung from the ceiling, casting light on the intricately embroidered silken carpets that made his feet feel like he was floating. Gold handles graced every door, and the walls were adorned with exquisite paintings and sculptures. Anwar was ushered into the living room by the pretentious robot that still had its nose up in the air. It announced Anwar's presence and quickly exited the room. The room was an immaculately decorated, pristine living space with plenty of velvety cushions and canapes scattered around. Dark green velour curtains draped the windows, and a golden bar full of strange-looking liquors was set up in one corner. Rows and rows of books lined tall wooden cupboards that adorned each wall. The room had a peculiar scent, a blend of coffee and spice. Farid was seated in a heavy-set armchair when Anwar entered. He remained seated, but looked up and grinned at him. "Welcome, Anwar Malik. I understand you are writing a book. Please, have a seat on one of the many comfortable chairs laid out in front of you," said Farid, with his usual cheerful grin. Anwar looked around the room and noticed several dozen chairs. He opted for the one closest to Farid. Anwar only remembered meeting Farid once in his life. He must have been rather young as well, maybe 10 or 12 years old. Strangely, Farid seemed much smaller now. Anwar still remembered the moment he had heard about Farid as a 6-year-old. They would later describe him as an angel that had dropped from the sky. Throughout his life, Anwar had pictured Farid as a 10-foot-tall, powerful robot who could crush his skull in his palms. Yet here he was, a feeble man who appeared neither strong nor powerful to him. "Yes, Mr. Tarini, I am writing a book on the history of our town. I have been doing my research, and I am at the point where you arrived in Sana. I was wondering if you could shed some light on it." Farid gazed at him intently, his eyes scanning Anwar so intensely that he thought Farid might be reading his mind. The silence was only broken when the butler walked into the room carrying a tray of refreshments. Anwar accepted the cup of coffee in good faith, but didn't fail to notice that Farid did not drink, even though 2 cups were laid out. "Aren't you going to have one?" The butler gasped as though Anwar had dared to speak the unthinkable, but Farid raised his arm at him. "I try not to have coffee too late these days. It affects my sleep. I am getting old, you know," replied Farid nonchalantly. "Nonetheless, I would say you don't look a day older than 41. The butler gasped again, and this time he was furious. He brusquely moved towards Anwar to grab hold of him, but Farid got up and shooed him out of the room. Anwar knew he was pushing his luck and wondered at which point he was going to be rehabilitated. "You have to excuse my butler. He's a bit particular." "So you were saying?" "Ah, I don't look a day over than 41. Well, thank you. Of course, I cannot take credit for it. I am a robot. After all, I don't age." The butler barged into the room. Anwar's teacup now lay shattered on the floor, his jaw hanging open in shock. The butler quickly cleaned up the mess, while Farid kept grinning at a stunned Anwar. He then promptly left the room, as though this was a common occurrence in the mansion. "What did you say?" asked Anwar in what was barely a whisper. "I am a robot, so naturally I don't age. But I am still prone to wear and tear, so we do age in that sense. And coffee certainly doesn't help my circuits," he replied, almost as though he were speaking to himself. "But I thought... Farid broke out into a fit of laughter. He got up from his seat and moved towards the window where the sunlight hit his plastic cheeks at an awkward angle. "You thought you couldn't talk about robots, or might I say boats?" he continued, laughing uproariously. "I was nevertheless impressed by your ingenuity in developing the new language, or shall I say the oven mitts are hydrating? Anwar was now on his feet, both terrified and confused at the same time. He wanted to leave the mansion, and yet to stay to ask more questions. "You knew about it?" he exclaimed. "Of course, it didn't take us too long, either. If you knew, why didn't you do something about it?" "Do what, Mr. Malak?" Anwar hesitated to say it out loud, but Farid had already read his mind by then. "Do not worry. Your life is not in danger. I agreed to meet with you to help you with your book. Nothing else." "I don't understand. I thought we weren't allowed to talk about you being a robot. In the past, you made all those people disappear," Anwar said, his voice quickly rising in panic. Farid laughed aloud again, this time in a much more condescending way. "My dear boy, why would I make them disappear?" "Then who did?" "Why, you did. Me. All of you did. You stopped them yourselves. It's part of your programming, after all." Mrs. Lincoln's China by M. Shane Bell. So I stayed in the crowd across the street, from the east gates to the White House. My son Cyril, he said to me, "Mama, I know how bad you want a cup of Mrs. Lincoln's to drink your coffee from, but stay back from those gates. If you're pressed up next to them, you're liable to get crushed before they give way. You don't have to be the first one in the White House to get a cup. You just come along when you can." I figured there was some truth to his words. 3 years before, my daughter, Lydia Ann, who was just 16 years old at the time, went early to the AC/DC reunion concert because the seating was open and she wanted to sit up close. She liked the drummer, and if you sit up close and take binoculars, you can see everything there is to see about a man sitting on stage in front of you, down to the kind of socks he was wearing. But a crowd formed up behind her and started shoving forward, and my Lydia Ann thought she was going to suffocate in the press of people before security opened the gates. And even then, 6 people got trampled to death when everybody rushed forward. So I looked at the crowd outside the White House gates and thought to myself, "Georgia May, you want a cup of Mrs. Lincoln's because you love her husband, and a cup of theirs would make you remember all the good he did. But there's no sense in risking your life for a cup President Lincoln might have drank coffee out of." So I took my Cyril's advice and hung back. Besides, I figured I had the advantage over most folks in that crowd. Most of them had come just to take whatever they could get, because they'd gone without for so long, and to maybe in the process scare the folks in power into running this country like it was meant to be a place where people could live a decent life. But me, I was going in with a plan. I knew just what I wanted to take from the White House. I'd toured the White House 2 years before and seen the China Room, and I'd looked and looked at Mrs. Lincoln's china and thought how she and the president I loved had eaten off those dishes. And when I started to see how things were going to go in this city and what was likely to take place with or without my blessing, I made up my mind to be in the crowd that would sweep into the White House and pick it clean. But I'd go there looking for the one thing, a cup from Mrs. Lincoln's china. Oh, that and maybe the saucer to go with it, and a plate or two if I could get them, which explains the 2 sacks I'd brought along to carry the dishes in, and the old dish towels I'd brought to wrap them in to keep them from chipping. But I would have truly settled for just one coffee cup. It was a hot, late August day, and about noon the crowd quieted down. It was hard to keep up the yelling and screaming when you were so hot you could hardly stand it, and sweat was making wet tracks down the front and back of your blouse, and all you could think of was how you wanted a cold drink of some kind, maybe a Coke with lots of ice. Some people tried to keep up the screaming and meant to rouse the rest of us to it, but it wasn't working. Only a few people yelled along with them, and I certainly didn't. Not then. I started to wonder if we'd get in the White House at all, or if we'd give up in that heat and go home, then try again in the evening or later at night. But I hoped we wouldn't have to rush the White House at night, because I didn't want to rush it in the dark. Storming a place like the White House seemed scary enough, without adding darkness on top of it, when suddenly the Marines guarding the gates just walked away, disappeared into the East Wing. Everybody in the crowd was trying to see what was happening, standing on tiptoes and looking, and suddenly it made sense to me. They were giving up. They were opening the place up to us without bloodshed. We were going to get in the White House after all, and in broad daylight. The president and everybody else inside were probably gone already, out tunnels in the basement, whistled off to Camp David or who cares where. The gates were locked, so people started climbing over them, and the fence, and walking a little warily up to the White House, almost, like they were going to buy tickets and take a tour. Two nice young girls gave me a hand up to the top of the fence, and we all three jumped down together onto the grass on the other side and made our way up the lawn toward the doors of the East Wing lobby. The doors were swung wide when I got to them and shoved my way inside, but some folks were already trying to shove their way outside, their arms full of figurines and paintings and the like. No dishes yet. I saw a lot of people just standing around, looking at the rooms and the things in them, and at each other, amazed that we were inside like this and that nobody was trying to stop us. For a minute, it seemed as if the spirit of the place settled over us. Here we were in the mansion where the great and powerful presidents of this land had lived, some of them good people, and it didn't seem right, somehow, to just tear into the place and start taking things or breaking them right away. But somebody outside threw a rock and busted out one of the front windows, and somebody started yanking down the drapes, and I knew the craziness was starting. I made a beeline for the China Room, and who should I find standing in the doorway but my own son, Cyril. "What kept you, Mama?" he asked. I was about to explain the fence I'd climbed, which I didn't find as easy a thing to do as I used to, when he grinned at me and held up a cup of Mrs. Lincoln's white china with a gold edge around the top and a purple border below and the eagle that represented this country. The cup looked so regal, yet fragile, in Cyril's hand, while the breaking and the shouting grew and grew all around us. Cyril put the cup in my hands. It felt cool and clean. It wasn't dusty at all. Someone had taken good care of this cup. "I want a saucer, too," I said, while I wrapped the cup in a dish towel and put it in my sack. "Wasn't there one with it?" Cyril stepped back so I could walk past him into the room, which was empty of people. Cyril's friends, Randy Lewis and Vincent Henry, were standing in the other doorway, and they grinned at me. They were holding back all the people to give me first chance at what I wanted. "We can't hold back these people long, Mama," Cyril said. "You've got to hurry." So hurry I did. I went straight to the Lincoln china on display in its china cabinet. I knew right where it was. All the china was displayed in order of the president, starting at the right of the fireplace, with pieces from the Washington's personal china, and stretching around the room to a place setting from the present president's set. In the spot for the Lincoln's china was a display of just 11 pieces from Mrs. Lincoln's first set, including the saucer that went with my cup. Most of the 175 pieces of Lincoln china left were kept up in the president's private quarters or down in a basement storage area, which I wouldn't have time to find. I opened the cabinet door, took out the saucer, wrapped it quick, and put it in my sack. That's when the lights went out. It being the middle of the day, plenty of light still came in from the windows, but the riot was clearly getting worse. I started wrapping and packing as quick as I could. A dinner plate, an ice cream plate, a teacup, and a saucer. I'd pretty well finished wrapping the Lincoln display. Water mug, 3 fruit baskets, custard cup, and everything when the shooting started. Away off by the East Wing lobby, Cyril ran up and took my arm. "You've got to go, Mama," he said. People had rushed into the china room once Cyril left the doorway, and they started smashing the dishes and the cabinets and tearing at the paintings on the walls and breaking out the windows. I grabbed up a few more dishes and shoved them in my sack. I decided to chance the chipping since I didn't have time to wrap them. It wasn't safe to stay here any longer. Cyril took my other sack and ran around the room, shoving dishes into it. I didn't know then from what services, and he came back and pulled me toward the door. I kicked the cabinet door shut behind me, on the off chance of saving what we left behind. The crowd was going wild, breaking and tearing at anything they could. "Stop it!" I wanted to shout. "These are good dishes. Take them home and use them." But nobody would have listened. Nobody could have heard me in that noise. Some fat man tried to kick my sack of china, but I swung it out of the way, and Cyril punched the man's face. "Come on, Mama," Cyril shouted. "I'm coming," I shouted back, but I couldn't help it. I picked up an unbroken bowl thrown down on the rug and 2 wine goblets from I don't know which services on the way out of the china room and stuffed them in my sack. Cyril helped me out of the White House, through a back door, and across the lawn to the fence, which surprised me. I thought he'd spend all his time in the White House having the fun he'd come to have with his friends, but he helped me over the fence, then handed me my sack of Lincoln china and his sack of odds and ends. I ran off down the street toward my apartment, and he ran off back toward the White House. I didn't see Cyril again for 3 days. I lugged my china home and got it up the dark stairs to my door. The lights were out in the stairwell. I still managed to get my key out of my pocket in the front of my skirt and open the door by feel without having to set down the china and chance shipping it anymore. I carried the sacks into the bedroom and carefully set them down on the bed. Then I opened the drapes to let in the sunlight and looked out the window. There were fires everywhere in the city, smoke rising up from one point of the horizon to the other, not to mention the shooting and the deeper sound of what must have been cannons over by Annapolis. Seeing and hearing all that made me sick at heart. I started to wonder, what if they come to burn the building I live in? I thought maybe I shouldn't unpack the china in my sacks. If I had to run, I could pick up those sacks and run with them. So I spent the evening getting ready to run. I locked the doors to keep people out till I was ready to go. Then I tried to call Lydia Ann, but the phones were dead. So I wrapped the Lincoln china I hadn't had time to wrap, this time in my good dish towels, and when I ran out of those and my good pillowcases, which I'd want to take if I had to abandon everything else. I didn't bother with Cyril's sack of odds and ends china because I didn't even know where it was in there, and I wasn't sure I had time. Once I'd squared away the Lincoln china and packed up some food and an extra change of clothes and took out the money I'd hid behind the fridge and stuffed it into the box of shredded wheat cereal I planned to take, I sat by the window in the bedroom and watched and listened to the riot and worried about Lydia Ann and Cyril. When night came, the city was lit up by fire. The shooting never stopped till 3 in the morning, when it stopped all of a sudden for about 20 minutes. All over the city I stood by the window then, looking out and wondering if the craziness was over so soon. But of course it wasn't. It started up again. I sat by my bedroom window all the rest of that night and into the morning, watching. By noon, since I hadn't run, I figured I might not have to. So I pulled all the drapes and dragged chairs in front of the door to block it and took a nap on the couch. I didn't want to move the china unless I had to, considering the pieces I hadn't wrapped in the second sack and the chipping I'd cause. So I left it all on the bed. When I woke up, it was dark. I tried the lights, but the power was still off. I felt my way into the black kitchen and pulled matches out of a drawer and lit a candle. I tried the phone to call Lydia Ann again and Cyril, but the phone was still dead. I tried to cook some supper, but the water was off. So I just made sandwiches out of the cheese and tomatoes in the fridge before they spoiled and drank some of the water I had left in a pitcher. Then I carried my candle into the bedroom so I could take a look at the china and Cyril's sack of odds and ends and wrap it. I reached in and pulled out a plate with a blue border and gold stems of wheat painted in that border. The American eagle was pictured in the white middle of the plate. I didn't know which president and his wife had had such a plate. Reached in and pulled out a dessert plate that had a pretty white flower in the middle. The back of the plate said Syringa, and below that, Idaho. I figured the Syringa must have been Idaho's state flower, but I didn't know which president's wife had ordered this plate either. I pulled out the two crystal wine goblets that were the last things I'd taken. They were simple in design, but lovely. I took the candle and went after the Margaret Brown Clapthorne book, Official White House China, 1789, to the present, which I'd bought after the White House tour I'd taken 2 years ago, and carried the book into the bedroom. I put the candle on the nightstand and knelt by the bed and started leafing through the book, looking for pictures of China that matched the china and goblets I had on my bed. The plate with gold wheat and the blue border turned out to be President Harrison's. Mrs. Caroline Harrison had painted the wheat herself, the guidebook said, back in the days when women did that sort of thing. I picked up the plate and looked at it again. The wheat was beautifully painted, and I realized that Caroline Harrison had been a real artist. Her work looked professionally done to me. The plate with the flower in the middle was the Johnson's. The guidebook said Lady Bird had ordered a service of china that pictured wild flowers, not the state flowers. Of all 50 states in D.C., people used to go on tours, hoping to see the wild flower from their state on display in a place setting from Lady Bird's china. I pulled two more plates from that service out of Cyril's sack. They pictured the California poppy and the Oregon grape, which meant I'd ended up with plates of the western states. I wish Cyril had picked out the plate with D.C.'s flower on it. I didn't even know D.C. had an official flower, let alone a wild flower. Maybe they'd used the dandelion or some other weed that grew up between cracks in the sidewalks. I started looking to see if I could match a picture to the wine goblets when there was a burst of gunfire just up the street from my building. I blew out the candle and didn't move in the sudden darkness. I heard shouting and more firing, then running in the alleyway below my window. I was glad I'd pulled the drape so no one could have seen my light before it was gone altogether. I knelt there next to my bed and smelt smoke from the candle, and listened to the shouting and the shots, and thought of my Cyril and Lydia Ann, wondering what was happening to them. When things had quieted down outside, I reached out and touched the smooth china of one of the Johnson's dessert plates. The people who'd ordered these plates were the people who dreamed of a great society. It hadn't lasted long. It hadn't even been many years before the ugly billboards Mrs. Johnson had torn down all over the country were put back up, and you couldn't walk down a street or take a bus ride anywhere without having gaudy billboards scream at you to buy this or that bit of nonsense. It was all tacky and cheap. Tacky and cheap was what too many people tried to make all of our lives and the world around us, but Mrs. Johnson had tried to fight that trend. She and her husband had dreamed dreams and worked as if they could make a difference in the world and ordered china with delicate wildflowers on them. It had been a time when grace and beauty had stood a chance. Over the next 2 days, I cataloged the china I'd taken. Of the Lincoln china, one dinner plate, one custard cup, one fish platter, one regular platter, one water jug, one ice cream plate, three fruit baskets, a teacup and saucer, and a coffee cup and saucer. of the Johnson china, one plate, three dessert plates. Of the Harrison china, one plate, one coffee cup and saucer. And in addition, two Kennedy wine goblets and one Hayes soup bowl with a crab painted on it. I wrapped everything in my best pillowcases and dish towels and kept them in sacks at the foot of my bed, ready for me to pick up and run with if I had to. I also wrapped two green depression glass plates of my mother's and put them in the sacks. I'd want them, too, if I had to leave everything else. 3 days after we stormed the White House, Cyril came knocking on my door. I recognized his voice, of course, so I dared drag away the chairs and unlock the door. And there stood Cyril with sacks of food in his arms. "I thought you might be needing a few things, Mama," he said. I hugged him and cried a little and asked him if he'd seen or heard from Lydia Ann, which he hadn't. I'd already decided I had to go and find her and help her if she needed it, but I decided to tell Cyril about that decision a little later. I asked him to tell me where he'd gotten the cooked supper and the food, but he wouldn't say much about that. I made him stay while I got it ready for us both. The gas was still on, and I dipped out all the clean water from the toilet reservoir, so I had water to boil with and drink. Cyril had brought me potatoes and a canned ham and all kinds of other canned things, soups and green peas and even a jar of instant Taster's Choice coffee. I put the ham in the oven to heat through and set the potatoes to boil and decided to set the table with the Lincoln china. I brought out my nicest white tablecloth and spread it over the table. The tablecloth had been my mama's, and it was way too big for any table I'd ever had. But I thought it was the tablecloth I should use with the Lincoln china. It hung down low, nearly to the floor, but it looked fine even so. I set the lit candle in the middle of the table. Then I unwrapped the Lincoln dinner plate for me and the fish platter for Cyril and set them out. They looked so pretty on my table, the dark purple of the border set off by my white tablecloth. The candlelight glistened off the china. I could imagine the President and Mrs. Lincoln hosting a state dinner, maybe for the ambassador from Japan, who would have come dressed in a kimono for men and whatever it was men wore in Japan back then, and all of them eating in just the kind of light Cyril and I were going to eat in. I unwrapped and polished the coffee cup and the teacup and their saucers and set them out for the coffee. My shoddy old flatware looked sad beside all the presidential finery, but it would have to do. Cyril stacked the furniture back in front of the door, then just sat at the table while I cooked. He was so tired. He told me he'd gone to talk to Randy Lewis, who had a shortwave radio and batteries to run it on, and that Randy had heard there was fighting and rioting all over the country. None of the networks were on, so we couldn't have gotten any news even if we'd had power to run a TV or radio. The potatoes finished cooking, and I whipped them by hand with butter that hadn't quite spoiled yet and canned sago milk, which works in potatoes when you don't have anything else. The whipping took a while, but Cyril and I both like our potatoes whipped, so I stuck with the whipping till it was done. I opened the canned peas and boiled them, then set water to boil for the coffee. When the ham was heated, I sliced it and made a gravy, and we sat down to eat. The food looked so good, and it smelled so good, and in the candlelight it seemed the shooting and the screams were far off somehow, though of course they really weren't. It struck me as a rare blessing that a mother and her son could sit down to a decent supper in times like these, and I was grateful to Cyril for his thoughtfulness to me. I dished myself some potatoes and handed Cyril the bowl. "I'm going to walk over to Lydia Ann's apartment tomorrow when it's light and try to find her," I said. Cyril looked up at me and took the potatoes. "I'll go look for her after supper," he said. "Don't you go out yet, not even in the day. It will be safer for me to go in the dark." I covered my potatoes with gravy and handed Cyril the gravy bowl. "If you go tonight to look for your sister, I'm going with you. I can't stand this not knowing about Lydia Ann. He took the gravy and shook his head. "Don't tell me no," I said, serving myself a slice of the ham. "I'm her mama, and I have to know if she's all right. If you say the darkness is safer, I'll go tonight in the dark, and I'll go alone, if I have to." He took the ham and didn't say anything. I'd told him about my decision to search for Lydia Ann in the same tone of voice I always used with my children, to tell them the discussion was over, and that trying to convince me to change my mind was a waste of time. He still recognized that tone of mine. We dished up some green peas and started eating. "Is the water ready for the coffee?" Cyril asked. I'd left it boiling on the stove. Cyril got up to get it and the jar of coffee, but the shoelace hooks in his boots caught the tablecloth, and Cyril stumbled and jerked the tablecloth forward, and the candle fell over and went out, and I heard Cyril hit the floor and dishes shattering around him. I couldn't move. I just sat there in the dark till I heard Cyril start getting up. I went for the matches then and another candle, and bumped into Cyril and told him to stand still and asked if he was hurt, and got a match and struck it and lit the candle and held it up. Cyril and I looked at each other, then at the table. "Oh, Cyril," I said. But he didn't say anything. Not "I'm sorry," or even, "Well, look at that." He seemed too stunned to say anything to me then. The fish platter was on the floor and busted, together with the teacup and saucer and my old bowl I put the peas in, all busted. But the ham and the potatoes and my plate of food and the coffee cup and saucer was still on the table. He hadn't pulled the whole tablecloth. I got the broom and dustpan and started sweeping up the pieces, and the sound of that china tinkling into my dustpan sounded like a judgment on us all, and I started to cry. And Cyril said he'd finished sweeping, so I handed him the broom, but I got out rags and tried to wipe up the mess off the floor, which wasn't easy considering how little water I had, and all the while I was crying. Everything was just too much for me then. When the mess was cleaned up and the tablecloth straightened, I sat back in my chair and just looked at my food sitting on a Lincoln plate while Cyril dished himself some more food on a regular Melmac plate out of my cupboard. "What have we done, Cyril?" I said. "The dishes would have all been broken anyway if we'd left them sitting in the White House, Mama. But that was not the point. Eat, Mama, if you want to feel up to going for a walk with me to Lydia Ann's," he said. "Don't patronize me," I said. I stopped my crying and stood up and got myself a Melmac plate out of the cupboard and scraped my food onto it off of the Lincoln plate. Then I ever so carefully washed the Lincoln plate and didn't begrudge it the water. I wrapped it up in a fine dish towel and put it in the unbroken cup and saucer back with the other dishes in the sack. Then I hid the snacks in the bedroom closet where thieves wouldn't spend much time looking, I thought, if they came in here. The china I'd taken was a duty I had assumed. I realized that now. It represented a heritage, not mine alone. The day would come when other people besides me would want to take a look at Mrs. Lincoln's china, and Mrs. Johnson's, and Mrs. Harrison's. They'd want to look and remember the dreams we'd once had in this country, and the kind of lives folks had once led. Till that time, I had a duty to safeguard what had become of my charge. Wouldn't the people in power some day be surprised when I walked up and handed them the china and said, "Look here at what I've saved for all of us." And I got other ideas. I sat back down to eat my cold food and told Cyril what I was thinking. "The minute it starts to look safe," I said, "I want to walk back to the White House and take a look around. I'll bet there's a cup or two that didn't get busted, and maybe a saucer thrown on the rug that didn't get break or trampled. There will be things there and here that I can pick up and bring back to save and take care of. Maybe I'm being called to do this, Cyril, or maybe I'm calling myself. It's folks like me, I guess, who will have to make ourselves responsible for saving some of our heritage through this time." He looked at me for a while, then finally started eating again. "I'll go with you to the White House," he said. "I don't want you going up there alone. "I'd be glad for your help," I said, and I thought how saving things like a president to China would give us a purpose to get us through the troubled days ahead. While I cleared off the table, Cyril told me how Randy Lewis had heard on his shortwave that they were talking about setting up a temporary capital in either Denver or St. Paul. I imagine they'll fight now over which one of those cities gets to be in the capital for a while, I said. Meanwhile, we had the living to take care of and a job to do after that. Little by little, we put the world back right. I sent Cyril to pull the furniture away from the door again while I dressed in my black dress so I'd look inconspicuous out on the streets. Then I set matches and a candle by the door for when I got back, blew out the candle and locked the door behind me. Mrs. Lincoln's china was safe for now in my bedroom closet. I set out with Cyril to find my Lydia Ann.